I guess I would have to interview myself to find out why it is only now. Let's see, we're talking at the end of May 2013, that we have as our guest at WFMT, David Lang. David Lang and Bang on the Can. Bang on a Can.
Yes.
Okay.
Only one can, please.
David Lang and his colleagues, One Can, have been around now for at least 25 years.
This is our 27th year.
27th year. There's been a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago. There's been lots of recordings, lots of performances. And for people who are bringing music to the widest possible audiences, I'm very embarrassed that we haven't brought him to you, at least as a person. We've brought you his music before. But here it is. We're talking in the basement of the Museum of Contemporary Art. David is in town as we speak, was in town as you listen, for the world premiere of Whisper Opera, which I'm saying like that because apparently it's supposed to be very quiet. I haven't seen it yet. Welcome, David Lang.
Hello, Chicago.
You have Chicago connections?
That's right. My parents actually grew up here and they met here. My father was born here and my mother was an immigrant from Germany who came here as a child and they met here and fell in love here, and
they met at a New Music concert.
No, I think they. I don't actually know where they met. Okay. I mean, I have some
as kids or as high school students.
They met as high school students.
Okay, but you weren't born here.
No, I wasn't born. I was born here in Los Angeles.
Okay, and well, let's talk a little bit about the Whisper Opera, though. Well, it won't matter here that you don't want people to know too much about it before they see it, because they can't see it here now, at least, when they hear this.
Well, the city will still be echoing with the resounding whispers from the Whisper Opera. It's actually a part of a larger project that I've been working on for many, many years, which is trying to figure out why live performance should still remain at the core of what we do as classical musicians. You know, I became a classical musician because I love performance. I love actually being there. I love being in rehearsal. I love watching the musicians exert themselves. And I love this magic happening right in front of you where nothing was before. Now with the internet, we can go at any moment and download illegally for free the best recordings and most carefully carved in the studio versions of every piece of music ever. Mm-hmm. We just have access to all the great music all the time in recording. And if that's true, and if live performance is going to remain the center of what it is we do as classical musicians, then it can't really be for the perfection of the performance or the high quality of the spectacular sound quality or whatever. I mean, all these things are surpassed online. Mm-hmm. So I've been experimenting with different ways to return live performance to the centrality of our business. So some of this has been making pieces which are so difficult that actually watching the people struggle is a big part of what the event is. You know, I have a couple of pieces that are really on the edge of playability and the effort to make these pieces.
Which ones do you put in that category?
Well, you know, I have a lot of incredibly difficult solo pieces, and actually, you know, a lot of them are really quite a struggle to do.
Yeah.
And some of them, you know, for example, I have a piece I wrote when I was very young. Actually, it's the first piece that I thought of like this, which is a piece called "Are You Experienced," which has a narrator part and a part for an electric tuba and an ensemble. And what was really interesting is that part goes up so high in the tuba part at the end, and it's so quiet and so delicate that really players can't play it. Mm. But what happens in live performance is you see the person trying to play it, and as their notes crack or as you can see their frustration at trying to get as close to perfection as possible, that takes on a very emotional quality.
Right. But we don't want to watch a high wire act on YouTube. We want to be under the tent and is she going to make it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You want to actually feel that you're in the presence of this risk being acted out mm-hmm. in front of you. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of pieces which ask for that in live performance, and I have pieces like the little Match Girl Passion, which is about a kind of community of listeners. So it seems like in order to get the power from that piece, you need to be in a room with other people listening to it.
We're going to talk more about that in a little bit, because the Little Match Girl Passion will be having its Chicago area premiere at Ravinia this summer in the Martin Theater in an Eighth Blackbird program, and we'll talk more about that. But yes, and everyone has spoken about how the struggle of the story and the struggle of the performance is tangible or audio tangible.
It's a big part of that room. And again, you know, we'll talk about this a little later, but being in a room full of people feeling something at the same time, mm-hmm. that community thing is something that at least I can't get when I listen to something on headphones,
right.
You know, on my computer. But in the case of the Whisper Opera, my idea was, what if you would make a piece that went out of its way to thwart being recorded, to make a piece that's so quiet that you're not being able to hear everything is a part of the piece, mm-hmm. that you're, where you've pointed your ears during the performance is a big deal, mm-hmm. and something that's so fragile that what's actually being presented in front of you is your own frustration at not being able to understand the world around you, mm-hmm. and not here's something that we recorded, just, you know, it was really quiet and we recorded it, and now we turn the volume down so that right. it masquerades as something really soft. You know, so it says in the score, I've sort of worked really hard to make this theatrical experience, which is very intimate and very delicate and very kind of confusing a little bit, you know, because mm-hmm. you really can't figure out, there is a story, you can't really hear it, and there's no synopsis printed, and there's no libretto in the score, and, you know, you can't really figure out what's going on, but something is going on.
And you're right there, too, as an audience member, right? People are seated on the stage, you've limited the seats to roughly a person a minute, about an hour plus, and you have 60 plus people.
It's less than a person a minute. I love that ratio, actually.
Okay,
you know, that's really good. Because then if you think of all those Mahler symphonies, you know, it's like, it really changes the perspective.
Right.
But the thing which I like about it is we've designed the stage specifically. I work with this great designer, Jim Finley, who also directed the show. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea was to give you this opportunity to listen in a way you hadn't listened before. So you're in this environment where, you know, you've never actually, I don't really want to give it away, but you've never actually heard music this way or seen performance this way. It's very... It sort of changes the way you feel about what's going on because mm-hmm. you're not experienced in the way you would be going to the same concert hall where you've heard 10 other concerts or 100 other concerts.
We can say that there are four instrumental musicians, though playing more than four instruments, flute, clarinet, cello, percussion.
It's those people who have those skills.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And plus a soprano.
And there's a soprano. And in this case, it's a wonderful Tony Arnold.
And the ensemble is the wonderful Ice Ensemble, which is great, which, of course, you know, is a mainstay of Chicago.
International Contemporary Ensemble.
Right.
Chicago and Brooklyn.
Yeah. But they do lots of other things in this piece. You know, they move, they talk, they whisper. There's something about their musicality, which is taken away from just playing an instrument and applied to all sorts of other kinds of actions.
You have both observed over your performance composition career and been a major part of why this has happened, that the ability of performers, particularly younger performers, to do all those things and also technically to play their own instruments beyond what many people ever anticipate. You know, there's going to be a guy in 10 years who can play your electric tuba piece and go higher than that.
It's really true.
And I think of the composers who were around for the latter part of the 20th century, let's say, and who wrote music that if, to follow Schoenberg's thing, it's not modern, badly played, you know. But I just was thinking the other evening, there's this wonderful gal from... Well, she's from all over the world, but she's based in New York, Miranda Cookson,
uh-huh.
violinist.
Right.
And she has been taking up composers that she never could have known and that she never heard of when she was growing up, Ralph Shapey, Luigi Nono. And she is playing them in ways that if they could come back on Earth, they would say, that's what I wrote. So you've seen this happen, and you all have kind of pushed these boundaries yourselves with Thing on a Can.
The interesting thing about it is, I'm obviously biased, but I think that being a composer is pretty much the best thing on the planet, right? So you have all these musicians, you have all their abilities and their talents and all this great history and this great repertoire. And you get all these kind of unruly, imaginative composers trying to think of things that haven't been done yet, or things that can distinguish themselves, or things that their imagination makes possible that haven't been tried yet. So what composers are always doing is they're always refreshing the field. They're always asking for something that's that maybe we're prepared to do, but we didn't know we could do it.
Right.
And I think it's really, you're absolutely right that our musicianship now is at a level which has never been seen in history. And especially young musicians coming up are listening to indie rock and roll, and they're listening to, the classics of classical music, and they're listening to all sorts of music from world music. And in our internet culture, they're putting them all together and building careers which were not possible a few years ago.
But they also are doing technical things.
But technically,
and right. Being musical.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can throw any score at 8th Blackbird or Ice, and they won't have any... They might have a question about Measure 18, but...
I think the interesting thing to think of is that this is true at all times through history.
Right.
And we only notice this one because we're living at this glorious moment where we see these people improving before our eyes. But if you think that probably there are high school orchestras now that play Beethoven symphonies better than Beethoven ever heard a piece of his.
Absolutely.
That's really remarkable.
Right.
What composers do...
It's a shame that classical music is dying, but yeah. No, yeah. But all
well,
those talented musicians.
I always hear that, right. and it's sort of, it's so interesting because, the level of playing in the American orchestra world is unparalleled.
Right.
And everyone is concentrated on the fact that we have a bad business model, or there's some things that are happening to make it so that we're nervous about the future. And it's definitely true that orchestras, some of them are on shaky economic grounds. But musically, we've never been better.
Right.
And that's actually kind of a liberating thought, to think that our field is actually moving forward in this incredible way. And what we need to do is not to... be depressed about all the things that we are losing, but to concentrate on building a structure that takes advantage of all the things that we now have.
And as you say, one, I agree completely with you, but also as you say, we're moving forward in every way. If you want now to hear live 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st century music, you can hear it better than ever. It's not as if, now we're only playing David Lang. I mean, it'd be an interesting world, or we're only playing Mozart. But we're playing everything and playing it with tremendous passion and commitment and expertise.
I think that's really true. I mean, I think it's kind of a gold mine, actually. Mm-hmm. The fact that all of these people in the world are looking for things to absorb their passion as musicians. So those people who are playing Mozart now, and are dedicating their lives to it, they do it with all of this history of performance practice and all of this great education and all of these great role models. And I think when you see some ensembles like 8th Blackbird or Ice with this incredible passion towards contemporary music, and you're someone who's in school with them at the same time, and you're not interested in contemporary music, but you're interested in Baroque music, you're going to look at them and you're going to go, those people have fire about that. I have to have fire too.
Right.
I think it's actually great for everybody.
And that can happen, of course, in both directions. There are plenty of new music people inspired by Baroque people. And of course, there are people who play Baroque and new music and leave the middle out.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell us a bit about how you came to these moments. You're now right smack dab in the middle of your 50s. Sorry to out you on that.
That's okay.
I'm right behind you.
I try to dress young, though.
You do. You succeed. And The reference to that early piece, of course, already has clues in it because you have an electric tuba and you have a title that is a direct reference to the great Jimi Hendrix, who existed live and on recording.
That's right.
Simultaneously. So my guess is, I might know the answer, but my guess is that you were picking up on these influences early.
Well, I was sort of I was not programmed to be a classical musician, and it was something that happened by accident. You know, the embarrassing story, which I can tell you, although I've told it before, is, you know, my parents, you know, were hardworking, education oriented, you know, really, you know, great, intense people. And classical music was not a huge part of my childhood. You know, we didn't have musical instruments in my in my family. And it was assumed from my childhood that I would go to medical school. And in fact, as an undergraduate in college, I was a chemistry major because I was trying to be a dutiful child, at which I failed miserably.
You and Jeremy Dank, we should get a little group
together. I know, the chemistry class.
Failed chemists.
I know.
Actually, probably not failed, but just chose other paths.
In my case.
In your case. Yeah. Jeremy probably not.
but so I saw a movie of a Leonard Bernstein Young Person's Concert when I was 9 years old, and he played Shostakovich's First Symphony, and he turned to the kids in the audience, and he said, you know, Shostakovich wrote his first symphony when he was 19 and became world famous overnight. And I remember thinking, I have 10 years, I could do that. and so the sort of fire got lit under me about wanting to become a composer. And I sort of learned everything about classical music from the composer's point of view first. I never really wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be a composer.
Right.
And so I started learning everything about composing, and I didn't know enough about the music world when I was in junior high school or high school to know that if I liked classical music, it meant I shouldn't be playing in a band with my friends. It meant I shouldn't be playing jazz, or I shouldn't be doing anything. I thought wanting to be a composer meant I had to like and love all composers on the planet of all periods, past and future. And so I became very, very interested in what anybody was doing in any kind of music. Then when I started getting more into classical music, and of course, you know, as my wife always tells me, my nerd credentials are really stellar. You know, I mean, I have a doctorate in classical music and I teach at Yale. As I got more and more into the field, I started being required, I felt, to specialize and to make value judgments about which world was better than which. And I think I really resented that. So when I was a bad boy, just out of graduate school, I started thinking, you know, my job should be to take these elements from rock and roll, or these elements from improvisation, or these elements from jazz, and see if I can use them to refresh classical music in the way that I was taught not to do. And I think that really Bang on a Can comes out of that too. You know, this idea that there's a world full of people who are doing interesting genre-defying things. And rather than say, you're mostly in the classical world, so you should be in the classical world, or you're mostly in the world music world, so that's where you should be, we just thought, what if you took all the genre-defying things from whatever genre they were defying them and put them next to each other? Maybe we would create a whole class of music that was about questioning the things that we inherit. And maybe that was a better way of listening to music anyway, is trying to figure out what's the music that's trying to be innovative, and what's the music that's trying to be conservative, and what if we stuck all the innovative music next to each other, regardless of where it's from. That's sort of the Bang on a Can ethos and how it started.
Thank you.
We're speaking with David Lang, L-A-N-G, American composer, music activist, creator, performer, bang on a can, festival presenter, thinker, and teacher, and other things. But we're hearing a remarkable story because it might be easy to start out with those ideas and those ideals, but you all have maintained them. What's the secret?
I think the secret of maintaining these ideals, for us at least, has been that there are three of us working together.
And let's name the other
there's
two.
There's Michael Gordon and right. Julia Wolf.
And they are a couple.
They're a couple, right. But they're also both incredibly interested and kind of, you know, craggy, passionate composers. Mm-hmm. And they both have very similar kinds of background to me. We all met at Yale.
Right.
We all met as graduate students, you know. We all came out of school and looked around at the world and went, you know, how come the music we want to hear isn't getting played? And mm-hmm. how come the audiences that we think should be listening to this music aren't here? And how come people aren't being treated the way we want them to be treated? And people aren't being educated the way we want them to be educated? And, you know, gradually, I think one of the reasons why it has worked all these years is that when I get a little tired of being involved, mm-hmm. I know I'll disappoint them if I drop out. Mm-hmm. You know, I know if I'm not absolutely committed to the organization at every moment, they'll get mad at me. And so so I have to, you know, like charge myself back up again. You know, we keep each other honest.
Right.
So
it's not just you. You think the others might have that feeling about the other two.
I think it's all this way. I think it's sort of, you know, I want
you all
to
picked
be,
the right group of friends.
We really did. I really want to be as committed to this idea as possible because I don't want to let them down.
Right.
And I think that they feel the same way about me.
The other thing, though, is, and as the great Nicholas Harnoncourt said on this program years ago, no names, no names. I will not name names, but we could take, perhaps less eloquent, perhaps as, we could take that speech or we could take what you've just said, and we all know there are groups and there are collaborative teams and so on that have been turning out the same nothing or the same something, but 30 years later, you can't tell when that album was recorded.
Right.
Or there are people who are saying these things and just not keeping their ears open. So there's a difference between having that posture and actually putting it. And I'm not saying these other people are devious or feel that they're not true to themselves about this, but you know, they're in a single aesthetic basically.
Well, it's easy to
get
stuck. You know, it's like when you find the thing that you want to do and you find something that satisfies you and you find a way to make money at it or whatever, you feel like, okay, well, I'm done.
Right.
You know, again, I think because we want to challenge each other all mm-hmm. the time. You know, it's like if Michael writes a piece that's, you know, super loud and obnoxious, I want to write a piece that's twice as super loud mm-hmm. and super obnoxious. And I feel like we're constantly trying to charge each other up about the mm-hmm. things which are possible that we haven't done yet. But I can give you a really great example of this
sure.
about what this is like for me personally, you know, because a couple of years ago I won the Pulitzer Prize, right, which was a giant surprise, very wonderful, and I was completely happy about it. And what happened after that is it became possible for people to work with me who had never worked with me before.
Right.
So what happened soon after I won the Pulitzer Prize was I got a call from the agent of an excellent string quartet whose name you know, who I will not name. Thank you, Nicholas Harnoncourt.
we can always credit him.
But I got a call from the representative of this really excellent string quartet who said, you know, we would really like to commission you. You've won this prize. You're really distinguished. We'd love to commission you for the string quartet. And I asked, you know, what does the quartet have in mind? And the agent said, well, you know, like a 20-minute piece that would go in between like a Mozart piece and a Beethoven string quartet, you know. So I said, so let me get this straight. So now I am distinguished enough to have the obligatory contemporary music slot on the concert that nobody listens to, where I can write the really dull piece that everyone just gets, that just goes through, right? You know, to get from the music that you like to the rest of the music that you like. And the guy said, yeah, that's basically it. You know,
at least he was honest.
You're at that level of your career where you can have that slot. So I said, well, thank the quartet for me very much. I really appreciate it. And tell them I'll write them a 90-minute string quartet. Because I thought, look, now if it's easier for people to work with me,
right?
Then one way to look at it is, you know, it'd be really easy for me to become a normal person at this moment and mm-hmm. have a normal career. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, if what I'm really interested in is finding out what people's comfort level is and where risk lives,
right,
and to find out the things for me that actually push me as a composer.
Sure. How about 7 2-minute quartets that would be played before and after each other piece, but without any set change?
You know, when I was in college as
next
an
time
undergraduate,
that agent calls.
That's right.
Yeah.
When I was in college, I wrote a piece of music where my piece was a piece of bubble wrap that I passed out to everyone in the audience. And my instruction in the performance was, before the end of this concert, you have to snap all your bubbles. So every
when and how you do it is up to you,
so
but before the end.
Every other composer on that program was very angry at me because you'd hear these very quiet, delicate pieces by my colleagues, and then all of a sudden you go, pop, pop, pop. So
what did Agent X say when you...
Well, the agent said, great, I'll take this back to them. And then the agent got back to me and said, you know, that's not what they're interested in, which is totally fine. They're still a great string quartet.
Oh, sure, sure. You know? But this idea of writing by the yard or whatever and that you would have a slot...
Well,
just...
it's the slot which was, I thought, most existentially problematic mm-hmm. for me. Because, again, with Bang on a Can and with everything I've done... my whole philosophy has been that music is capable of doing things we haven't done yet. Mm-hmm. That music is capable of expressing emotions which are so subtle that we haven't figured out how to name them yet. That music is capable of reaching audiences that we haven't tried to reach yet. And so my job as a person in every part of my musical life should be to solve all those problems and not to say, okay, well, here somebody offered me $5 to jump off the merry-go-round and, you know, and have a nice meal. You know, if someone is saying to me, now we're willing to take those ideas about audience or music or questioning or innovation farther, that's an incredible gift for me.
Yeah. It's funny when you just said that. My friend and I just saw the 90th anniversary restored re-release of Harold Lloyd's Safety Last, where he's hanging from the,
the clock
minute hand
in
downtown Los Angeles, maybe. I mean, that's where it's happening, but where he really is, apparently nobody's ever quite been able to document. But it happens in part because he overhears the heads of the department store where he's working as a clerk say, I would give somebody $1,000, this is 1923, if they could get people into this store and do something we're not thinking about.
Right.
And he says, I got an idea, I'll do it. What if I could get a man climb up this building? Because he has a friend, his one friend from his little town, is a human fly. And the actor who plays the friend is a then famous human fly. But what he winds up with is Harold Lloyd climbs up this building in pointy dress shoes, and he's really doing it. He's not a stunt person. And if somebody came up to you and said, I want to give you $5 and a nice meal, there's a merry-go-round, figure something out, that might intrigue you or might have at the beginning, no?
It might, yeah. I mean, at this point... you know, there are all these things I'm curious about. So it has to be the right merry-go-round, you know. And I don't want to just push envelopes for the You know, I'm not a troublemaker. No, I mean, So the other odd thing about also winning the Pulitzer is you know, everyone started talking to me as if I was the former barbarian, you know. And the weird thing is, you know, with Bang on a Can and with my background, I never really wanted to be a barbarian.
Right.
I never imagined that I was doing anything that was bomb throwing for the sake of bomb throwing.
Right.
I never imagined that I was being an animal. I just was asking kind of fundamental questions. And likewise, now that I could see it in my future that I could become a lion of culture, I don't want to do that either.
Right.
You know, I just want to ask better questions.
Thank you.
David Lang's The Little Match Girl Passion, written in 2007, Pulitzer Prize winner, and then a Grammy nominee in 2009, will have its Chicago area premiere Monday, August 26th at the Martin Theater at Ravinia in Highland Park. Grant Gershon will lead and perform with three other soloists in the vocal and percussion parts of this amazing piece. And Eighth Blackbird will also appear at Ravinia with music of David Lang, These Broken Wings, written for Eighth Blackbird, 2008, and music written for them as well, The Birds, recent music by Nico Muley and Andy Akiho. So all of that is a can't-miss concert for the summer, for the year, Monday, August 26th at Ravinia, 8 p.m. in the Martin. Music that we heard on tonight's program, we started with Press Release, written in 1992 for bass clarinet virtuoso and bang-on-a-can man Evan Zipporin. That's from David Lang's 2009 album on the Cantaloupe Music label, Music from the Film, parentheses, Untitled. Midway through, we heard I Lie from 2001, setting of a Yiddish poem in translation into English by Yosef Rolnick, and that was performed by the Ars Nova Copenhagen on the 2009 Harmonia Mundi USA release of The Little Match Girl Passion with another group and other music with Ars Nova Copenhagen. We went out with the 2003 solo piano work, This Was Written by Hand, from the 2011 David Lang album of the same name, Andrew Zolinsky, the solo pianist. Lang had always written his works by hand with a pencil, but when he got his first computer in 1993, he started writing on the computer, and 10 years later, he thought it would be interesting to see what happened if he wrote with a pencil again by hand. We'll bring you part two of our wonderful, I thought, conversation with David Lang next week. And we want to thank our hosts at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, who set up our opportunity to talk with David Lang in mid-May when he was there for the Whisper Opera Chicago premiere with the Ice Ensemble. Carla Loring, Peter Taub, and Yolanda Chesta Kursach. We want to thank them very much, in addition, of course, to Matt DeStefano, who recorded at the MCA and put the program together back here at WFMT and made it sound great. Our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought of this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. WFMT.com/critical thinking, the Critical Thinking podcast, where you can hear the always free Critical Thinking podcast. Chime in at WFMT.com. Send us a paper airplane. There are many ways to reach us. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week, and I hope we'll also see you at Ravinia for The Little Match Girl Passion.